I invite your attention as we gather again today for not two, but three capstone presentations. The format will be a bit different because we're going to move directly from one presentation to the next until all three have occurred. The only interruption will be that I will introduce each person immediately preceding their presentation. Because we are holding Q&A for all three until the end, you were handed as you came in, I hope, a piece of paper and a colored pencil for you to jot questions and notes, comments that you would like to share when we've completed all three. So, the first presentation will be by Darren Bousset. It's entitled Human Wholeness and the Dissociative Effects of Post-Combat Trauma. Darren is currently the pastor of Mount Zion United Methodist Church in Mount Solon, Virginia. He's been in that role since June of 2014. Darren brings a unique educational experience training in civil engineering at Stark Technical College in Canton, Ohio. And in his resume under previous employment, I noted involvement in a variety of managerial roles, Wood Grain Innovations, Rockhouse Farm, and Mount Vernon Farm. So Darren brings a variety of experiences to bear, and I'm confident that his experience as a veteran is woven well into the topic that he will address us. So Darren, welcome.
For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to take up what is planted. A time to kill, and a time to heal, a time to break down, and a time to build up. A time to weep, a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance. A time to throw away stones, a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek, a time to lose, a time to keep, and a time to put away. A time to tear, a time to sow. A time to keep silent, and a time to speak. A time to love, and a time to loathe, a time for war, and certainly, and most assuredly, there is a time for peace. For many who have engaged in combat, their time of operational war is over. It stopped when they turned in their equipment, exited the military, and came home. However, their time to rebuild, to regroup, their time to heal, and their time for peace isn't as easily defined. Millions of combat veterans are plagued with feelings of detachment, detached from their friends, from their family, from their neighborhood, even at times detached from themselves. Hundreds of thousands of combat veterans live every day in a void which they cannot escape. Many of these veterans endure this experience alone. They grieve silently, but as the writer of Ecclesiastes puts so poetically, there's a time to keep silent and a time to speak. So with that being said, I am grateful to be honored to be given the opportunity to share with you my primary exploration of human wholeness as it pertains to the dissociative effects of combat trauma. We'll begin by examining the commonly held beliefs about the fullness of God, see how these perceptions inform our insights about human wholeness, and only then do I think we can delve into the matters of post-combat trauma. And each of these are very, very important because they speak into how we can better appreciate why the community of faith is being called to respond. God's grace is poured out onto the world, but in the way we experience that grace is through the images of God that we have grown to recognize. Within our Christian tradition, We have come to accept this symbol as an illustration of the triune God. But can we say that this is a complete representation? One could argue that this icon is made up of disjointed segments that are incomplete. So what if we completed this circle, added color, added dimension, and by using biblical language, assigned names or values to these spheres? Is this now a complete image of God? Well, very quickly, when we look at the scriptures, we find that there are more descriptors, names, and adjectives for God. They are more than could fit on this slide, more than could fit on this wall, and if we tried to exegete them, it would probably take a lifetime or multiple lifetimes to do that. Wouldn't it be convenient if we could sit in the presence of the God and say, how would you like me to represent you to the world? What shall I call you? Well, there was one individual who had that opportunity. Moses asked a very similar question. And God said to Moses, I am whom I will be. This is what you are to tell the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. So what does this one passage tell us about God? That God is always present. God has always been and God will always be. And when we read the broader context of the Israelites' release from captivity, we learn that God is, was, and will always be connected to creation. For an individual who feels abandoned or betrayed by figures of authority, this reassurance of the constant presence of the ultimate authority is invaluable. This I am identifier is also not exclusive to the Old Testament. Within the Gospel of John, Jesus is quoted several times as using this I am identifier. But there's one that I find most intriguing, and that's John 8:12. Now, I don't claim to be a Greek scholar, and I use my Greek lexicon pretty loosely. But as I picked up Thayer's and started to parse things out and put different meanings to it, something really, really kind of spectacular came into my mind. Another way that we might not necessarily interpret, but engage the scripture, is what if Christ were saying, I am the reason, the mind of the universe. The one who walks the same road as me will not conduct their lives in resulting misery, but will have the power of understanding the physical body and the spiritual. Now, I realize that's really pushing this text right to its breaking point. But if we can find those kinds of messages of hope and reassurance in this sort of a text, imagine someone who's feeling distant from God, or feeling miserable, or feeling as though their life is worthless. What strength and reassurance they can get through the scriptures. As we reach to heaven to grasp the vision of God, God's love also shines down on us to illuminate who we are and how we are to see ourselves as divinely created beings, made in the image of God. If we visualize the stream of Christ's pure light being projected through the prism of human experience, we can imagine God's radiance extending into every aspect of human existence. This radiance defines and provides substance for our physical well-beings as well as our emotional well-being, just as much as it does our spiritual well-being. Now, independently, these three different elements of humanness can be examined, unpacked, compared, compartmentalized in a myriad of different ways. But an amazing phenomenon happens when these separate circles are overlapped. The resulting light becomes clear. The individual shafts of light, when reintegrated, shine with the same brightness and intensity as the original source. In the same way, when our independent facets of our human existence are integrated, the wholeness of this result has the same radiance as the light of life. Now, these images of human wholeness can be beautiful. They can be symbolic, informative, and even therapeutic. But as we know, life is messy. And in our fast-paced lives, things like exercise routines, meditation, prayer, all of these just become scattered, splattered things of our lives. And it's in almost a loosely controlled chaos. This is no truer than for those who have experienced combat. For many, the stress of combat, the stress of this traumatic events can leave them wounded in ways that are difficult to understand. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, the fifth edition, or the DSM-5, provides diagnostic criteria for PTSD. As of 2013, there were two new specifications. This is delayed expression and the dissociative subtype of PTS. Now, in the interest of time, we can really only focus on the dissociative subtype. And it's identified in two principal different areas, derealization and depersonalization. I've heard people describe derealization as though they were half awake or mostly awake, but everything around them was in vivid detail. Every sound, every color, every movement was just precise and crisp. It's as though they were real, but the rest of the world kind of wasn't. And then depersonalization is like sitting in the audience at a movie about yourself, and you're the principal character, but you don't really have control over what's going on. I heard one gentleman say to me one time, he goes, "It's okay because at least it's not happening to me. It's happening to that me." When the reality was, it was happening to them. It can be very disorienting and very confusing sometimes when your sense of reality is kind of skewed. In recent years, another form of trauma has been recognized that shares many of the same symptoms as post-traumatic stress. It's called moral injury. Service members can often encounter any number of moral and ethical challenges in war. They may do things that are contrary to deeply held moral convictions. They may be conflicted over unethical behaviors of others. And warriors often witness things of intense human suffering and cruelty. And that shakes the very core of their trust in humanity. Now, this is not a physical condition, but it's an emotional one. Even though these emotions do affect our body and our state of mind, in the case of moral injury, no amount of medication, no amount of psychotropic drugs will ever have any lasting effect. Now, along with PTSD and moral injury, I propose that there is another category of combat trauma. Now, I refer to this as spiritual fracturing. And there are those who will disagree with me. They state that moral injury sufficiently addresses the spiritual aspect of ethical trauma. However, moral injury does not fully account for those who can adequately reassimilate themselves into society, but feel that their actions in combat are unforgivable. Some combat veterans have said, "It doesn't matter if I believe in God or not, I'm going to hell anyway." While others may claim that they would rather be thought of by their coworkers, their friends, their family as heroes, because if they had to face God with what they had done, God knows who they are, and God won't ever forgive them for that. Even among military chaplains, they're often discouraged to delve into those questions of spirituality. Their job is to minister to and provide pastoral care for the faithful. Anyone who is outside of the faith or seeking faith, they're referred to their family pastor. Most of these veterans don't have that resource. Now, in my research, I very accidentally stumbled upon a flowchart, and being a civil engineer, I love flowcharts. And I believe this diagram does a really, really good job of identifying the different aspects of moral injury. If we look at it, it actually shows the cycle of disorientation, going from that confusion to exhaustion to confusion. And this can last in a combat veteran for years, sometimes their whole lives. It also shows the cycle of avoidance. That's usually once someone has withdrawn from a family member, a church organization, they go through this cycle of blame and anxiety, And they just continue to try to work out, try to make reason out of things that are unreasonable. They try to rationalize things that are irrational. And they just get caught on that treadmill. And it also very clearly shows the cycle of shame. Now, shame is just one of those things that can completely consume you. It can prevent you from doing basic things like remembering to eat, sleep, or even bathe. Shame just takes over every aspect of your life. Now, I can't remember her name. Oh, Brené Brown, thank you. Brené Brown was quoted as saying, "Secrecy, silence, and judgment are those three things shame needs to grow exponentially in our lives." So for people who are disconnected with their community, their family, or themselves, it's almost impossible for them to break out of this cycle of shame. Where this framework kind of not fails, but where it comes short, is that there's currently not any acceptable way out of it. There's one track, there's one path that leads out. That's from transgression to a psychotic break or suicide. I think this is where the faith community has the opportunity to step in and try to break these cycles by instituting its own cycle, a cycle of spiritual healing, where we take that perplexity and we give people purpose, we give them meaning, so that they can find healing and find Sabbath. Because as we continue to make deeper meaning and understanding and have greater healing, we can rest more assuredly in the arms of God. By doing this, we've taken that transgression that's at the far left, and we replaced it with transformation. That's, in a sense, cutting off the root of all the other aspects of moral injury. When we can find ourselves as transformational leaders, as transformational people, all of these other aspects eventually can be worked through. Now, over the last 150 years, modern medicine has done incredible things to improve people's physical quality of life. Within the last 100 years, the mental health institution has completely transformed, has completely renewed how veterans were taken care of. And even within the last couple of decades, the military itself has done a wonderful job of caring for the spiritual needs of active duty military and their families. The task at hand is when individuals transition out of the military to come back to their homes. Often they don't feel that there's a church family that's open to come home to. Now, there are a handful, and I have to say a handful, of faith-based veterans organizations. One is SAFE. It's Soldiers and Families Embraced. Now, they provide all their services free of charge with no insurance required. And they are dedicated that they will never deny any person basic care based on age, sex, religion, disability, national origin, or sexual orientation. There's another organization that's actually been around for a long time, been around for about 20 years, and that's MAVA, the Muslim American Veterans Association. They are there to support and help all veterans of the United States Armed Forces, regardless of religion, race, or gender. And the relatively new kid on the block is the Veterans for Christ Corporation. They were founded in 2005, and it was a veteran who founded it for veterans, and they're in the Dallas area, but they're doing their best to continue more in Texas and California, where there's the highest concentration of veterans, certainly the highest concentration of those diagnosed with post-traumatic stress. But what can our local congregations do? Well, we need to tell people that veterans are welcome, that our churches, our institutions, are places of healing and not of judgment, not of criticism, not of shame. We need to be open to veterans' needs, and we need to share the good news of forgiveness. Sometimes we just forget that we know that Christ, we know that God is there to forgive others. We just forget that it applies to us as well. Sometimes we kind of need a little kick in the pants to be reminded of that. We need to listen to veteran stories and sit with the veterans where they are, not simply physically, but where they are emotionally and where they are spiritually. I think that's how we offer genuine friendship and unconditional love. Now, for everything, there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. There's a time to gather. There's a time to gather the lost back into the bosom of Christ. There's a time to mend what is broken. There's a time to offer healing and forgiveness. We are living in a time of war. As repugnant as that is, we cannot avoid what is happening and what has happened. But certainly, and most assuredly, now is a time for peace. Thank you for your time.